The last few years, I've gone around teaching on dreams mainly, but more and more about sleep, because dreams only make up a small percentage of sleep, actually. You know, the dream is not the majority of sleep. So what I found is if we just focus on lucid dreaming, which is the main thing that I teach, we're missing a trick here. Because there are loads of other practices you can do. Conscious sleeping, falling asleep consciously, making use of the hypnopompic, which is that stage of kind of drowsiness before you enter full wakefulness. And as part of that, I got interested in how we sleep. And I was shocked by the amount of people who claim to suffer from, or believe they suffer from insomnia. So just as a show of hands, who here would refer to themselves as a sufferer of insomnia? Suffer. Life is suffering. God, okay, first of all, let's change that label. Don't call yourself a sufferer of insomnia. Let's be an explorer of insomnia. Because if you're lucky enough to have it kind of raise its ugly head, then at least we can explore it as we suffer it. So I call this workshop Exploring Insomnia. We've only got like an hour, so the full workshop's actually a kind of a half-day thing. So I'll just be kind of going through briefly what we've got. So insomnia is or sleeplessness is often a better way to refer to it rather than insomnia, because insomnia is such a loaded word. But sleeplessness is the inability to fall asleep or the inability to stay asleep once you've fallen asleep. So for a lot of people, they can fall asleep at night, but then a few hours later, they wake up and they're like, oh God, I'm a freak. Everyone else is asleep. There's something wrong with me. I'm an insomniac. And then we wear this big label, like a big chain medallion around our neck that kind of weighs us down because I'm an insomniac. My teacher, Rob Nen, who's quite a well-known South African meditation teacher, he's defined insomnia as trying to fall asleep, which is quite an interesting one. The process of trying to fall asleep leads to or is symptomatic of insomnia. If you look at kind of stats online, it says about 1 in 10 people suffer from what they class as kind of chronic insomnia. But actually about 1 in 3 people suffer from sleeplessness at some point in their lives. So why are there so many insomniacs? It could be something to do with this label of what makes an insomniac. Or it could be to do with the kind of lost sacredness of sleep. You know, most of us go to sleep when we're too tired to stay awake, right? That paradigm is broken. This means sleep is in a negative context. When we can't stay awake anymore, we go to sleep. Or when there's nothing else on TV and we've done all our emails, then we'll go to sleep. Rather than going to sleep as a positive process. So one of the things we can start to do is look at sleep as something active. You know, we talk about falling asleep, which is another very kind of passive label here. We fall into sleep. And actually on the workshops and retreats I run, we learn to float into sleep or abseil into sleep. You know, there's something active there. You're letting yourself down into sleep. And insomniacs love that. Because something that a lot of insomniacs have is a hypervigilance over the process of falling asleep, which is misinterpreted as something bad. Because we think, oh, I'm not falling asleep, I'm too aware. When in fact, awareness into sleep can be a very beneficial spiritual practice. So it seems that there might be a lot of misdiagnosed insomniacs based on a lot of the labels we've got out there. So let's look at some of these labels. Transient insomnia is having insomnia less than once a week. Short-term insomnia is less than a month. Chronic insomnia is more than a month. To have it for more than a month. So if you have sleeplessness for over 30 days in a row, you are apparently a chronic insomniac. And if you're a chronic insomniac, you're going to know about it. You're going to have full-on daytime hallucinations. Your diet's going to be up to spout. Your eating habits are going to be up to spout. Your memory is going to be down the drain. So to be a chronic insomniac, you've got to seriously have, you know, a serious problem with sleeplessness. So actually, most of us are not chronic insomniacs. Most of us are transient at most in our insomnia. There's also something that's interesting called subjective insomnia. So this is a kind of new label. which is based on people who are actually sleeping for a full 8 hours or so, but subjectively it feels like they've only slept for four because they're in this state of hypervigilance. Now, we sleep in 90-minute cycles. It is very normal to have a state of wakefulness at the end of every 90-minute cycle. So often insomniacs, because they're hypervigilant, become aware of these awakenings every 90 minutes. They misinterpret this for a lack of sleep and the fact they haven't been asleep at all. In fact, what you're displaying is an awareness which is very beneficial to those sleep and dream practices, especially within Buddhism. So if you do find yourself aware every 90 minutes, that's totally cool. And actually what you're displaying there is a very aware sleep cycle. And the paradox is, bringing more awareness into sleep helps us sleep better, not worse. So we could go into the reasons for having good sleep, but to be honest, in an insomnia workshop, the bang on about why sleep is so important isn't that good, because you guys are going to get, you know, complexes around, oh, this is even more why I'm so, you know, screwed up, I can't sleep because of this and that and that. The easiest thing to think about sleep is that it recharges your potentiality. Don't think about recharging batteries. Think about recharging your potentiality. We can be more engaged, fuller expressions of our own potential if we sleep well. So it's something that's worth aiming for, but it's something that we need to completely reconsider what good sleep is. What are we aiming for? 8 hours of blackout, is that good sleep? Perhaps, but perhaps not. What I want to look at is the history of sleep. Because once you learn about the history of sleep, you realize that the 8-hour blackout is in the experimental phase, and we don't even know whether it works very well yet. So get to know the personalized character of your sleep. If you do have wake-ups in the night, be aware of them. Don't clock-watch, but be aware. How many wake-ups am I having? When am I waking up? How long have I been asleep for? Just be aware of it. Learn how you sleep. Because there are two things we don't teach children. We don't teach them how to sleep, and we don't teach them how to breathe. Because sleep and breathing are automatic actions. Think of the amazing things that can be done by learning how to breathe. Yoga, meditation, holotropic breath work. All of this stuff is about learning how to breathe. Taking a process which is seemingly automatic and making it a little bit more manual. We can do the same with sleep. It's an automatic process, but if we become more aware of it and make it a little bit more manual, we can actually learn to sleep better. So we have this Western view of good sleep being 8 hours knockout. We even have that thing, sleep like a log, right? Oh yeah, great sleep, I slept like a log. Guys, don't sleep like logs. You are sentient beings with the potential for a full realization, and we want to sleep like logs, dead pieces of wood? This is ridiculous. Sleep like a tree with growth, a tree with chi, with awareness. Sometimes we need to sleep like a log, definitely. Had, you know, crazy week at work, you've got kids screaming in your ear, sleep like a log. But it's the exception, not the rule. And if we set up this expectation that only when we are sleeping like a log are we sleeping well, we are constantly rejecting the inherent nature of our sleep, which is not to sleep like a log all the time. So we need to reconfigure this view of sleep. So how many wake-ups a night makes you an insomniac?
So one long one.
One really long one, yeah. What else? How many wake-ups? Maybe. Well, let's start with eight. Even if you were to have 8 wake-ups a night, this is still part of a perfectly normal sleep cycle. If you're waking up 8 times a night, you're still totally normal. Once you start hitting double figures, yeah, perhaps you want to start looking at it. Does anyone in here wake up more than 8 times a night? So we're all wonderfully normal. Even if you're waking up 5, 6, 7 times a night, you're normal. This is a normal sleep pattern. Totally normal. Don't believe me, you can believe David Nibauer. He's one of the leading experts on sleep and insomnia research. Thinking it's necessary to stay asleep for 8 hours straight is unrealistic. Even waking up every 60 minutes can be part of a healthy sleep pattern. But the problem is, most people are unaware of these brief awakenings that we have every 90 minutes or so. Insomniacs are hyper-aware. This is one of the symptoms of insomnia, hypervigilance, hyper-awareness during sleep. So because insomniacs are hyper-aware, every one of these wake-ups, they go, oh God, I'm awake again. I'm a freak again. There's a problem again. And what happens then? Big bolt of cortisol and adrenaline to the brain, to the heart, and suddenly we're more wakeful, so it's harder to get back to sleep. Do yourself a favor. When you wake up in the middle of the night, just remember this. It's totally cool to be awake in the middle of the night. In fact, even if you're awake for a good 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the night, that may be very, very normal, as I want to look at now. So research shows that we have been hardwired since prehistoric times to spend a section of the nighttime awake, fully awake, engaged in wakeful activity. This 8 hours solid sleep is in the experimental phase, and it doesn't work very well. Before the 1800s, which is the much larger part of our human history, of course, most humans slept in a very different way. They slept in two sleeps. So two sections of sleep. And if you look back and research for this in the old Middle English, in the Middle Ages, it's actually written sleep is kind of old English spelling of sleep, you know, Y-P-T-E. So how did we used to sleep like this, and why did it change around the 1800s? So before the 1800s, we would go to sleep when the sun went down. Of course, this depends upon seasons and stuff like that, and when the sun rises and falls, but you'll go to sleep when the sun went down. You would sleep for 3-4 hours, then you would wake up at about 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and you would stay awake for a couple of hours. You would go and visit your friends. You would go and milk the cows in the fields. You'd go down the pub. The pubs would reopen. Isn't that amazing? That has been happening for thousands of years, right? So if you find yourself that you fall asleep for 2-3 hours, and then you wake up and you feel bright as a button, and you go, God, man, I could go and milk my cow right now. Then rather than being a freak, from an anthropological point of view, you may be displaying a much more natural sleep pattern. The real freaks might be the guys who are sleeping for a full 8 hours solid. This should be a big burden off your shoulders if you suffer from sleeplessness. This is a very natural sleep pattern. So people would stay awake for a couple of hours. Apparently they'd also have sex. It was supposed to be a great time for fertility. So you'd kind of wake up, get jiggy, and okay, so we're done. And then they'd go back to sleep again for another few hours. So they were still getting between 6 to 8 hours sleep, but there was this kind of break in the middle. So then you wake up when the sun rose and stuff like that. Now around the 1800s, this changed. What happened around the turn of the 1800s? Industrial Revolution. That's when all our problems start. Okay, so Industrial Revolution. Lots of different ways to look at this. You could look at it as that factory workers needed people to work in the factories longer. You could look at it, you could blame it all on the industrialists, or you could look at some specific details that happened in London at around the time of the Industrial Revolution. Now, London at the time was the centre of the empire. I can only apologise to my forebearers, guys, but it was the centre of the empire. We were trampling over every other country in the world. So things that happened in London spread very quickly to the rest of the civilised world. Three things happened in London at around the turn of the century. Coffee houses hit London. So suddenly people were G'd up on psychotropes and could stay awake longer. Edison released the first affordably available light bulb. So there'd been light sources around before, but suddenly this light bulb was affordable. People could have it in their coffee houses, in the street lamps even in their house if they're rich enough. And thirdly, an interesting one, there was a little revolution in the printing press. They worked out how to make paper much cheaper. So they started printing out these novellas, and the increase in literacy levels, so people could read the factory things and the, you know, to be the workers in the factories, meant that people could read. Books that they could afford, they could have lights rather than the expensive whale oil candles that they had before, and they could have coffee to keep them awake. This changed our sleeping habits, combined with the fact that the 9-to-5 day became kind of implemented around that time. So the way that we sleep now, kind of going to sleep 10, 11, 12 o'clock, waking up 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, and doing kind of 8-hour day at work, this started then. Before then, we did not work as much as we work now. The working week has been far extended since then. And our sleeping patterns have been disrupted since then as well. So 1800s to now, what? We got a couple of hundred years of this. This is experimental phase. We do not know whether this works. It could well be that in 500 years' time, we look back at this stage of our history and think, wow, do you remember that crazy time when they all tried to stay asleep 8 hours straight and they thought they're crazy if they didn't? Do you remember when they woke up and worked from 9 to 5 every single day? You know, maybe that will change too, who knows? But know this. Know this because not a lot of people don't, and not a lot of people do. And once you do know this, it changes your perception of sleep. Now, luckily, about a month ago, BBC News, on their international website, released an article all about this. So hopefully that will help this get out to the wider public. But tell people about this, especially if you know some insomniacs who wake up bright as a button at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, depending on when they went to sleep before. You're not a freak. You may be displaying a very, very normal sleep pattern, which may be much healthier. Now, of course, not everyone tries to sleep in 8 hours straight anyway. We are monophasic in our sleep patterns in the West. So we're talking kind of America, Western European countries. If you look at Mediterranean countries, how do they sleep? They sleep biphasically. You know, they go to sleep a little bit later, 5-6 hours sleep, do half a day's work, have 2 hours kick in the afternoon. Biphasic sleep pattern is a great sleep pattern to be in. So if you are an insomniac and you think, oh, I only had 5 hours sleep last night, don't worry about it. See if you can catch a nap in the afternoon. Even if it's when you get back from work at 5-6 o'clock, that's fine. You know, don't think, oh, I can't sleep now because then I won't be able to sleep at night. It doesn't really work like that. If you've got the little bit of sleep debt from the night before, you'll kind of catch it up and then sleep well the following night. So how do we sleep nowadays? Nowadays, most of us try and go for this kind of 8 hour sleep cycle. And without going too much into the sleep cycles, the first 4 hours of your sleep are dominated by deep delta wave sleep, which is usually dreamless, and this is restorative sleep. So this is where your fingernails are growing, your cells are replicating, human growth hormone is released, all this kind of stuff, and a little bit of dreaming. The second half of the night, so the last kind of 4 hours of our sleep cycle, is mainly dreaming, with a little bit of delta wave deep sleep. So the first 4 hours are where you get most of your restful sleep. The last 4 hours are where you do most of your dreaming. The restful sleep, the delta wave sleep, is to restore your body, and the dreaming sleep is to restore your mind. So from a neurobiological point of view, the point of dreams is memory reconsolidation. So you reconsolidate memory through dream. So say you're a caveman and you get attacked by a saber-toothed tiger. That night, or for several nights after, and this is one of the points of trauma dreams, you will dream about that again, rehearsing different ways. What happens if I attack the saber-toothed tiger? What happens if I run up the tree? You are rehearsing survival mechanisms. And there are some neuroscientists who believe that is what helped us to get to top predator. Because out of all the mammals, and all mammals dream, but out of all mammals, we are the ones who can have these reflective dreams to rehearse kind of fight and flight processes in the night. How much sleep should we get? A lot of people ask it. It's like saying, how many calories do we need? Totally varies between men and women, young and old. And a bit like calories, it depends on how much physical work you're doing. You know, if you're, you know, breakdancing all day, then you probably need more sleep than somebody who's maybe sitting at a computer all day. So you know how much sleep you need. If you wake up the next day and you feel tired and you feel that your memory isn't sharp, perhaps you need more sleep. Just in the same way as, how would you know if you need more calories? Because you'd be a little bit hungry and a little bit grumpy. Same with sleep. So don't let anyone tell you how much sleep you need. Work out how much sleep you need yourself, depending on your intake. But having said that, it seems that the old adage of 6 to 8 hours sleep is pretty advisable. But it doesn't have to be all in one go. This can be 6 to 8 hours sleep in each 24-hour period. So don't worry about getting it all in one go. You can break up your sleep and that's fine. But if you can try and be getting kind of 6 hours sleep every 24 hours, that's pretty good. So this guy, Ruben Neyman, who's one of the leading research scientists on insomnia, and he's got some tips. We'll look at his causes first. His top 5 causes of insomnia, and each one of the causes has a tip to work with. So these are really interesting. Number 1, overexposure to light. We need darkness to trigger the production of melatonin. So you have serotonin and melatonin. Now, serotonin has been caught up with this kind of happiness hormone thing because of its effects with ecstasy and stuff like that. It's not actually a happiness hormone, it's kind of a wakefulness hormone. So light, exposure to sunlight or blue ray, because blue is the particular color of sunlight, blue ray light leads to stimulation of serotonin, so it keeps you more awake. When you experience darkness or shaded conditions, serotonin goes down, melatonin goes up. So to feel tired, to want to fall asleep, we need to reduce our exposure to light. So this is both natural light and electronic light. Okay. Who spends some of their last hour before bed looking at a computer screen? What is the easiest way to pump blue light, serotonin-boosting light, into your bloodstream? Look at a computer screen, okay? So try and give yourself at least a window of about 20, 30 minutes if you can, but 20 minutes minimum before bed, where you reduce your exposure to light. Do not check emails. TV is weird. It's actually, TV is kind of hypnotic. It can actually help people get to sleep because it's so brain numbing. So TV is a slightly different category, but not kind of right up close to the TV. Lights down. Go to candlelight half an hour before bed if you can. It's pretty cool. It's like fun. You're kind of preparing a ritual around going to sleep, and it will really help. At least dim the lights. If you try and go from bright exposure to light or checking your emails in bed, worst thing to do, and then expect to go to sleep. That's going to really, really affect your chances of falling asleep. Excessive energy, number two, top reason for insomnia. Excessive energy. So both our bodies, minds, environments become energized through overindulging. Overindulging in what? Food, entertainment, stimulation. All of these things, we become overstimulated before bed, and we need to reduce some of this if we're to sleep properly. So try and reduce your energy consumption, light, processed food, energy, as you approach the night. Basically, try and chill out. Don't be having a crazy kind of mind-stimulating debate with your partner before bed. Don't spend half an hour checking your emails before bed or having exposure to a light-emitting screen. Hot body, hot brain, this comes on from this. Hot body, this is really interesting. So I'm sure we all want a hot body, but not in this case. We don't want a hot body. Because there's a hot body that causes a lot of insomnia. Literally the heat in our bodies. A lot of people who have insomnia wrap themselves up in loads and loads of blankets. Oh, I'm going to get really, really cozy and fall asleep. But actually you mess with the kind of thermoregulation system in your body, which then keeps you awake. You know, it's a bit like hibernation. If you look at hibernating animals, actually, they don't kind of cover themselves. They're actually kind of in an enclosed space, but they're kind of free. They're letting their bodies do their thing. So don't be too hot. Don't turn the heat up. If you want to know the perfect heat for your room, stick your toe outside of your duvet or your whatever your cover is, and if it's a bit too cold outside, like you want to pull your foot in, that's the right temperature. If you can have your foot outside the duvet and not notice it, your room is too hot. So when the sun goes down, the earth cools. And the same thing happens with our bodies. But now in this modern world, we don't cool our bodies down. Our bodies stay hot, they stay energized, they stay wakeful, right up to the point that we fall asleep. Because we have this notion, when do I go to sleep? When I'm too tired to stay awake. We need to change that paradigm. It doesn't work. Oh, here we go. We've actually got the thing. Set a maximum bedroom temperature for 68 degrees. Lower is better. And intentionally increase your output of energy during the day by exercising more, but not more than 3 hours before bed. So you know sometimes you feel kind of jiggly, you've got loads of energy in your system. Go and do something. Like go for a run, do some press-ups, do some star jumps, do whatever. But get rid of this energy before bed. Because if we go to bed and you've got that kind of, you know, restless syndrome, that kind of, I don't want to talk about restless leg syndrome, kind of restlessness in your body, then it's going to be much harder to sleep. And as you all know, if you like do a long run, you sleep really well that night. So bring exercise as part of your daily regime to help you sleep. And hot brain, an agitated mind, as well as an agitated body. Try and sort things out before you go to bed. Try and conclude, or at least kind of call a time out on whatever argument you've been having before bed. You know when you close your eyes when you get into bed, and you enter the hypnagogic state. So So this is a transitional state of mind between wakefulness and sleep and dream. Your hypnagogic state is often made up of the predominant content of your day. So if you've spent your whole day kind of worrying about a certain thing, you know, when you close your eyes to get into bed, that thing pops up, right? So we need to try and work with that and try and make the things that pop up relaxing and sleep inducting rather than things that re-stimulate us. And this hot brain thing isn't really so much about the content, it's about the way we think. It's about ruminating over certain things. That's what we want to try and avoid. And number 5, inadequate sleep settings. Most of our sleep settings are created around generation of energy, not reduction of energy. Have a look at your bedroom. Does your bedroom look more like an office or more like a bedroom? How many electronic things are within arm's reach of your bed? Because the length of an electromagnetic field, which comes from anything that's plugged in and on, is about a meter, about the length of your arm. So if there are electronic things which are plugged into a power source within arm's reach of your head, they will be disrupting your sleep pattern. Because you have a tiny little magnetic field around your head, around your brain, and a tiny little magnetic field around your heart. And these things can disrupt it. So maybe you need one alarm clock or something like that. But if you've got things plugged in, you know, your laptop charging, then your iPhone charging on this side, and all this kind of stuff around your bed, that's really going to affect your sleep. So try and move those things away, at least arm's reach. And have a look at your bed. You know, does your bed invite sleep? Or is it like a sofa that you sit on all day and then eventually you fall asleep in it? Beds should be for 2 things, for sleeping and for having sex. If you're using your bed for anything other than having sex or sleeping in, there's a problem. Don't use your bed as an office. No emails in bed. TV in bed, I know we like to do it sometimes. Try and reduce TV in bed, at least. Or, you know, sitting up and doing things on your bed. Move away. Have your bed for sleeping. Also, there's a lot of toxicity in our bedrooms. Does anyone have one of those Tempur mattresses? You know, the ones that you kind of sink into, they're really good for your back. I used to have one until I found out they're really toxic. So a lot of it's kind of plastic, wool in there. And this is kind of, you're breathing it in. So one thing you can do is, a lot of people are more sensitive to things than they think. So for your duvet, check, do you have a sensitivity to duck feathers, if you have a feather duvet? Or maybe you have a sensitivity to polyester. But be aware of these things. At least try and have kind of organic cotton on your sheets. Because a lot of cotton has been dyed with a lot of stuff that doesn't get washed out, and you're kind of breathing that in as you sleep. Oh, at least even out with some plants. Put plants around your bed. These will help to give out oxygen and take in carbon dioxide. Plants around the bed really help. If you're into the kind of chi of plants and stuff like that, then that's a belief system that I'm into personally. So you can look at that too. But if not, you can at least look at the fact that they are helping to cleanse the air around your bed. And psychological safety. This is an important one that a lot of us don't want to admit to. Do you feel psychologically safe in your bedroom? If not, get a lock on your door. Even if you just share the house with your mum and dad or your loved one, doesn't matter. If it would make you feel better to have a lock on your door, put a lock on your door. Have a sense of psychological safety in your bedroom. Do you feel safe sleeping next to your partner? If not, then perhaps looking at sleeping in separate beds. Sleeping in separate beds does not mean you don't love your partner anymore. It means you're into your sleep. Like, my girlfriend's a really great lucid dreamer. So sometimes if we're doing practice, we'll sleep in separate places. Because when she's having lucid dreams and I move, I wake her out of her lucid dreams. So sometimes we do sleep separately. It doesn't mean we love each other any less. It means we love each other enough to let us really get into sleep, you know, and do these practices. So have a look at that. If you don't feel so safe sleeping next to your partner, it's not that you think your partner is unsafe. It's that sometimes we don't trust ourselves. You know, I think, oh, I look ugly when I sleep, or I'm going to fart in my sleep, or like I'm going to wake up bad breath, all this stuff. We have a lot of these little insecurities which are unconscious, and they really affect the way we sleep. So look at them, acknowledge them, and work with them. The top 5 myths of insomnia. Now, this is cool, because a lot of these things we totally buy into. Again, it's from Ruben Neyman. A good sleeper falls asleep quickly. This is not true. A good sleeper does not fall asleep quickly. It normally takes at least 20 minutes to surrender to sleep. And in fact, in the workshops that I run, so this weekend I'm doing the lucid dreaming workshop in Grahamstown, one of the exercises we do is to try to not fall asleep quickly. So insomniacs love that. Because they're like, oh, I'm really good at this. All you guys are falling asleep, but I'm just here. So we can start to review this, because sometimes falling asleep quickly isn't such a good thing if we want to bring mindfulness and awareness into our sleep patterns. A bad night ruins the next day. Not all the time. We are built to resist. As humans, we are the top predator on this planet. It takes more than one bad night's sleep to like completely deplete us of our human capacity, guys. We can complain the whole day after we lose one night's sleep, but we are built to resist. Think of people in war zones and stuff like this. You can, you know, you can survive. You are built to survive. So maybe if you've had like 5 nights of no sleep, then we can start to think, okay, there's a problem here, I need to deal with this. But a couple of nights of no sleep, it's not such a big deal. We create a big deal because we create labels that we're freaks and there's something wrong with us. It can actually be quite interesting to explore the next day after no sleep. You know, it can be an interesting state of mind to be in, so look at it exploratively. Number 3, nighttime wakefulness is bad, so we've looked at that before. Nighttime wakefulness is not bad. It can be a sign of a very natural sleep pattern. Number 4, I can and I must control my sleep. You cannot and you must not control your sleep. We can become friends with our sleep and learn to abseil into it, learn to float into it. But once we start to control it with I must fall asleep now and if I wake up there's a problem, we're creating a lot of tension and a lot of distrust around our ability to fall asleep. Resting in bed when I can't sleep is useful. For most of us, if you can't sleep, the best thing is to get out of bed and do something. Because every moment you spend in bed, when you can't sleep, you're associating the bed with failure. The bed is a space of failure. Out in the world, I'm fine, but in bed, I fail. I can't get to sleep. So you're creating this kind of performance anxiety around the bed. Okay? So move out. Unless you know how to practice hypnopompic mindfulness, which is a certain practice that you can do in the in-between state of sleep. And if you do the weekend, then we'll learn that practice. But for most of us, it's unhealthy to stay in the bed if we can't sleep. So get out, do something, come back. Reading is a great thing. Reading novels or fictional literature. Just 6 minutes of recreational reading changes the shape of your brain. No, sorry, changes the shape of your brain waves. Just within 6 minutes. In fact, the latest studies that came out from in the New Scientist said that it's almost that fictional reading creates an altered state of brain, an altered brain state, just 6 minutes. So don't read anything logical. Harry Potter, sci-fi, Lord of the Rings, right brain stuff, creative stuff, stuff that you have to imagine. Dream is a right brain dominant activity. Imagination is a right brain dominant activity. So lock into imagination and you are locking into dream. They come like that, so be imaginative. Okay, so some... I want to look at some exercises from some of this stuff that you guys can actually do. But before that, I want to look at sleeping pills, just a little bit. Does anyone here take sleeping pills? Any more than one person? Any more than 2 people? Okay. Not quite sure about doing this section then. Not because it won't mean anything to you, but because when there's only 2 people and you're talking about something that needs to be reviewed, it feels like the whole room is going, thump. And I don't want that to happen. So what we can say is, yeah, perhaps, if you regularly use sleeping pills, review this, because there was some stuff that came out a few months ago on BBC News website, so you can check this all, bbc.co.uk News Health, that actually linked persistent use of sleeping pills to increased risk of death. And they did all these double-blind studies and controlled the conditions and everything, but they kept on coming back. So if you are regularly taking sleeping pills, review it. So the Center for Preventative Medicine study looked at a wide range of sleeping pills, including the three most commonly used ones in the UK. They found that people prescribed these pills were 4.6 times more likely to die during a 2.5 year period compared to those who did not use the drugs. Do you know how long the study was? 2.5 years. This means that over the time of the study, people were dropping like flies. They were dying as the study was happening, these people on sleeping pills. So they put this study out there kind of very tentatively, and then more and more studies kept on piling in. They don't know why, but they know it's a direct link to persistent use of sleeping pills and death. And it's not just that people on sleeping pills might be depressed, and it's not just that they might be, slightly spaced out and step in front of cars and stuff like that. They're controlled for this stuff. They don't know why, but they know there is a link. So if you or a family member are using sleeping pills regularly, just look to review it. Don't stop taking your medication without talking to your doctor, of course, but review it. And your doctor may not know about this research. This only came out a couple of months ago, but look into it because it's quite shocking. Here we go. Researchers are not yet clear why the risk exists, but it could be that the drugs have a sedating effect and may make users more prone to falls and other accidents. It could be that the drugs have been linked to increased suicide risk, or it could be that the drugs have been linked to increased risk of cancer. They don't know yet, but there's definitely a risk. Okay, let's look at some of these exercises. Of course, it's all very good talking, but I want to leave you guys with some stuff to do. So the first exercise we need to do is a breathing exercise. So breathing tends to happen in this part, so we need to make this part straight. So if we straighten off our backs and yet stay relaxed, then it'll help us to breathe a bit better. What is the bridge between wakefulness and sleep? No, what's the bridge? What takes you from wakefulness, full wakefulness, to sleep?
Relaxation.
Yeah, relaxation, rest. So there's a bridge of rest and relaxation that most of us do not engage in before we go to sleep. We turn off the light like that and expect our brains to do the same. It doesn't work like that. The reason it takes people so long to fall asleep, often up to kind of 40 minutes or even an hour, is the fact that first of all they've got to rest and relax. And then once they're rested and relaxed, then they can start the descent into sleep, which takes about 20 minutes normally. So if you can engage that 20 minutes of relaxation or rest before you go to sleep, then it will seem like you're falling asleep quicker, which for insomniacs is something that's worth doing. So this is called the 4-7-8 breath. You find this in a lot of yogic practice, but it was kind of pioneered by this sleep researcher who found it had direct benefits to help people get to sleep quicker. He refers to it as a natural tranquilizer for the nervous system, which, unlike tranquilizing drugs, which often lose their power over time, with this exercise, it gains in power with repetition and practice. So for this, you can do it when you're sitting on the edge of your bed, or you can do it while you're lying down in bed. You do it when you're sitting on the edge of your bed, it makes it more of a kind of a meditation. So what we're going to do is we're going to breathe, and the breath is going to be according to 4 counts, 7 counts, and 8 counts. So we breathe in for a count of 4, we then hold the breath for a count of 7, and then breathe out for a count of 8. Does that make sense? Yep. So the inhalation is through the nose, the exhalation is through the mouth. We're going to repeat 4 times, 4 repetitions. And just doing this now, you'll feel a change in your body. So, keep your eyes open if you can. A lot of Tibetan Buddhist meditation aims to keep the eyes open. Sometimes when you close your eyes in meditation, you're creating a barrier between the meditation and real life. Whereas if you keep your eyes open, there's no barrier. Your meditation flows into real life. So keep your eyes open if you like. Close them if you want, but try it with your eyes open. I'll count you on this one first, because I can't count and do it at the same time. So breathe in for a count of 1, 2, 3, 4. Hold your breath for a count of 6. Breathe out for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Breathe in for 1, 2, 3, 4. Hold for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Exhale for 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Breathe in for 1, 2, 3, 4. Hold for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Breathe out for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Last time, breathe in for 1, 2, 3, 4. Hold for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Exhale for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Now drop the practice and breathe normally. Can you feel effect? Isn't that weird? What was that, like 2 minutes? So there's an aspect of kind of pranayama to that, kind of the breath hold. And you don't need to clench on that or anything, no kind of perineum clenches or anything like that, just hold the breath. You do that for 4 times before sleep. I don't know how it works. I keep on looking for more research on this as to why it's linked to sleep. I want to find some sort of yogic research that's linked to the subtle channels in this chakra and that chakra. I can't find it, other than the scientists say it works. And I've tried it, and people in this workshop have tried it, and it really works. So you can do that before bed. You can do it in the middle of the night when you do wake up. So even if you have kind of 8 wake-ups in the night, do it 8 times, that's fine. So do it when you wake up in the night, do it before you fall asleep. You can also do it in the middle of the day. It's a great way to refresh yourself. It's a great thing to do in the morning as well. You might think, oh, in the morning, I want to wake myself up. But the thing is, this meditation is kind of like a vector. It's a bit like ginseng. You guys know ginseng, the herb? Ginseng is a great one. It increases blood flow to the parts of the body which you're asking it to send blood to. So if you take ginseng before meditation, it will help you, it will send more blood flow to the brain, help you be more meditative. If you take ginseng before sport, it will help you be more active. You know, it's a kind of a vector. It sends blood where it needs to be sent. That's a bit like this practice. So you can even do it in the morning. It'll actually help rejuvenate. Another thing you can do in the morning, which is really good, is take a light bath. So you know we talked about serotonin and melatonin. So when you've been asleep all night, melatonin levels rise, serotonin drops. And for a lot of insomniacs, they feel very sleepy in the morning. So one thing you can do is give yourself a light bath. You guys live in a sunny country, so go out into your garden and literally sunbathe. Just stare up at the sun. You can have your eyes closed, but just stare up and just bathe yourself in sun. Just allow yourself to really wake up. You know, at least kind of 4 or 5 minutes out there. If you can't, then you can bathe yourself in blue light. So these probably have a higher percentage of blue light in them, actually. So does your laptop screen. I don't think you should, like, stare at your laptop at 30 in the morning. But have a look at it. This brings me on to another tip, a little kind of footnote here. Alarm clocks. Who here wakes up in an alarmed state? Who invented that? I mean, that's ridiculous. So, okay, what's the best way? What's the best start to the day? This. It's an alarm clock. We're in a state of alarm. And we wonder why we've got this nervous energy all day. One of the best investments you can do is to get yourself a chilled out alarm clock. So what you can do, you go on Amazon. You guys have Amazon here, yeah? Or you can get them in shops anyway. They're these kind of Dawn's simulation alarm clocks. So they've got a light bulb in them. Let's say you want to wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning. At 6:30, the light starts going on very, very faintly. And then by the time it's 7, it's bright enough to penetrate your eyelids. And at the same time, there's a corresponding sound. So for me, I always choose the birds. and it kind of fades up, a bird's tweeting. By the time we get to 7, it's so loud it will wake you up. But it's such a great way to wake up in the morning. And all my dreams end with birds flocking through the sky. Really cool. Best investment you can make, you know. And also look at the state of your bed. Have a good bed and good shoes. If you're not in one, you're in the other. Good bed and good shoes. If you're not in one, you're in the other. That's a fact. And yet the amount of us who walk around with shoes that hurt our feet or beds that are uncomfortable to sleep in. Now, both shoes and beds are quite expensive, so there's an investment there. But if you look at the amount of minutes that you spend in your shoes and the amount of minutes you spend in your bed and you work out how many rand per minute, actually a bed is a bargain. Yeah? Really? So invest in a good mattress. You know, so many times you've got mattresses that hurt us or the springs are coming up or something like that. Invest in a good bed. It's not a luxury, actually. You know, get something, it doesn't have to be an expensive one, just something that feels good to sleep on. You might like a very hard bed, you might have no mattress at all, but work on that, because you spend a third of your life in there. There's no other place that we spend a third of our lives that we don't spend a lot of time choosing. We spend a third of our lives in bed, maybe we spend the other two thirds in our work environment and our home environment. Think how much time we spend looking at the home we're going to buy or live in, and how much time we spend looking at the career path we're going to take. But there's a third of our life that we just say, whatever, I'm blacked out, I'm sleeping like a log. Incorrect. You know, we need to look at that third of our life and see how we can make it more beneficial for ourselves. Okay, let's do another exercise. If you've got pen and paper, you can actually do this as a written exercise. Most of you don't, so do it as a thought experiment. It works both ways. So this is a contemplation. Contemplation is interesting. If you look at it as we're going to kind of settle our minds, so our minds are a little bit more settled, don't worry about meditation or that, we're just going to settle our minds so we're a little bit more mindful. And then the contemplation question is going to be dropped. And allow it to drop like a pebble in water. So try and perhaps, you know, still the water of your mind just a little bit by coming into an awareness of your breathing. And then when the pebble drops, just watch the ripples. That's it. The exercise, the clue's in the name, it's called What's on Your Bedside Table. So, let's straighten our backs and be relaxed if we can. Eyes open or closed, it's up to you. But because this is a thought experiment, you might want to keep them open. Because often when we think, we kind of look up and look side and look down and stuff like that. So don't feel you need to stay static on this. First of all, just be aware of when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. It's the only instruction. You might like to make your breath just a little bit deeper. It'll help you with the awareness of when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. Don't try and blank your mind or stop your thoughts or anything like that. Just know when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. In your next out-breath, just drop any regulation of the breathing and just sit there. Bring your bedside table to mind. What does it look like? What's on it? Photos, glass of water, sleeping pills, a lamp. A clock, a radio, earplugs, a book. What's on your bedside table? Just bring it to mind, just imagine it. In your head or on paper, whatever you want, try and list all the things that are on your bedside table. So just in your head, try and list them. My alarm clock, my lamp, my laptop, my book, whatever it is. But list all the things on your bedside table. If your bedside table has a drawer, Try and recall what's in it. What's in the drawer of your bedside table? Take a moment to consider all of the things which are on your bedside table or in the drawer of your bedside table. What does this tell us about how you relate to your sleep? And how do the contents of your bedside table affect your sleep? Try and be a detective. Say you're a detective and you come into the bedroom and you've seen this bedside table, your bedside table, and you're trying to work out who this person is. How do they view sleep? What's on their bedside table? What can we learn from this person by looking at their bedside table? How many things on your bedside table contain an electromagnetic field? So how many things need to be plugged in for them to work? So if they're battery powered, that doesn't count. How many things on your bedside table are plugged into the mains? How many things on your bedside table relate to timekeeping? How many things on your bedside table are related to work? If you were to give an overriding theme to your bedside table, what would it be? What is the theme of your bedside table? Okay, so, in Buddhism, we have a lot about shrines. You set up like shrines, and the shrine is a focal point of your spiritual practice. So if you're doing your meditation, you might do it in front of your shrine. And your shrine will contain certain things which help inspire your spiritual practice. So for me, I might have a Buddha on it, something like that. If you're Christian, it might have a picture of Jesus or Virgin Mary. So things that help inspire our practice, and by looking at someone's shrine, you'll be able to tell what religion they were into. You'll be able to tell what practices they do. The bedside table is like your shrine to sleep. What does your shrine to sleep look like? Is it full of junk and dust? Our bedside table, the drawer on our bedside table, is often the frath drawer. That's what my girlfriend called it. In our room, we have a frath drawer, and it's not the bedside table drawer. But the frath drawer has, like, old denominations of money, elastic bands, paper clips, this kind of stuff, old files. How many people have frath in their bedside table drawer? One frath, two frath, three frath, four, five, six. Okay, frath in our bedside table drawer. I know it's in a drawer, right, so it's out of sight, so at least it's not on the bedside table, but we still know it's there. And what sort of signal does that send out to us, to our unconscious? It says, sleep, you know. I associate it with stuff that I don't need. What was the state of your bedside table? Any feedback on that? What was the theme of your bedside table?
And a glass of water.
Good. So did you feel your bedside table felt correct?
Yes.
Great.
So even though I have insomnia, it's really full.
Yeah? Good. How many people felt their bedside tables could be improved? And how?
Well, mine is very austere because it's just my phone and my glass and the lamp. Very stratified. Okay, let's get my sleep. And, you know, if it goes pear-shaped, then I am going to be the next day. Maybe setting it up in a way that's more relaxing.
So that's interesting. So you felt there's a reflection on the austere nature of your bedside table that reflected your kind of hard and fast view of sleep.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how can you soften it up a bit?
All the stuff like reading and reading before waking up. dog study working at 5 in the morning, so he can't breathe.
Uh-huh.
I get grabbing
Yeah. You know, the last thing you look at night and the first thing you look at in the morning, apart from your partner, is often your bedside table. So just like your partner, make sure you're attracted to it. Or things aren't going to work out. You know, if you've got this horrible old bedside that you've never liked, that your mum gave it to you when she moved house, and you've got this thing, and you hate it, and you've got a horrible old throw over it, that's not good vibes, guys. This is the last thing you look at before you go to sleep. The same as your as the bed. You know, if you've got this horrible old duvet covers, you really hate the colour of them, that's not really going to work. So try and make it easier for yourself. Think of your bed and your bedside table as a shrine. Create something sacred around going to sleep. Even create a ritual around going to sleep. If we've been doing emails up to 5 minutes before bed and then expect to knock out, it's not going to work. Sleep can actually become a spiritual practice. It can be something that we engage, not just to recharge our batteries, but to get to know ourselves. Because if you really want to get to know someone, look at how they sleep and look at how they dream. You know, these detectives in these kind of crime movies often think if they really want to get to know a suspect, look at their sleep and dreams. Look at what time they go to bed, what time they wake up in the morning. Look at their bedside table. Look at whether they remember their dreams. Look at their view of sleep and dreams, and you can tell a lot about someone. So if you really want to get to know yourself, look at how you sleep and look at how you dream. And if you sleep in a crazy way where you wake up 8 times a night, does that mean you're a freak? Maybe. But just as freaky as everyone else who's trying to sleep for 8 hours. We've got to wrap it up now, guys, but the main thing about insomnia is to change your perspective around it. Drop the label insomniac, you know? Don't cling to it. Some people often, they're kind of proud of it. Oh, I'm an insomniac. Oh, no, I can never get to sleep. I love it. Look at my big story. Insomniac. You know, we hold this thing. And a lot of us, we're not insomniac. We suffer from mild sleeplessness. And if you suffer from mild sleeplessness, then great. We get colds every now and again. It's not a big deal. And it doesn't mean that we're broken. If you are waking up less than eight times a night, there's nothing wrong. If you're spending 2 hours or even 3 hours fully awake in the middle of the night, there's nothing wrong. If it takes you more than an hour to get to sleep, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing more personalized than the way you sleep. Don't let anybody try and depersonalize that for you. How many books you read or, you know, talks like this you come to, only you know the way you sleep and how much sleep you need. So work with that and get to know the way you sleep.